is not only hearing from Fatih, but also listening to each other. So looking forward to that. I also wanted to mention when he made the comment about he being a different kind of speaker than me, I get paid to do this. Fatih is a volunteer leader of the Pacifica Rose Foundation, and he's a much more gifted engineer than I am. I can tell you that. Fatih, welcome.
Again, thanks for having me here. And I'll say the same thing. You know, I'm more interested in hearing from the congregation here to on the issues, rather than me talking. So, but I was asked to start with an introduction on what is Islam, right? So before I go to a historical 1 minute review of Islam, let me say, if somebody asks me, can you summarize it with one sentence? What's the heart of Islam is? I would quote the verse in Quran which says, "Fathkuruni askurkum washkuruni wala takfurun." God is telling the mankind, saying, "Fathkuruni askurkum" means, remember me, so I will remember you. "Washkuruni wala takfurun." "Washkuruni" means be thankful to me. Do not. "Wala takfurun" means do not be one of those betrayers. So in my mind, the essence of the religion, in a sense, is really this. No, recognize God, that he has created and everything that we are in right now, the world and the sun and the universe and everything. Recognize him, be thankful to him, and remember him. And when you are doing that, of course, be gentle to others, help the poor. And there are many verses that we read from Quran and, you know, helping the poor and the needy and the parents and everything. But the center is basically remembering him, knowing him, and thankful to him. While you are doing that, be kind to others and helpful to others. So if you look at the pillars of Islam, if you put that in the center, actually all the other pillars of Islam is really serving this main central goal. Example, you see people, Muslims, praying five times a day. What is five times praying five times a day? Essentially, it's remembering the God and thanking the God. You know, in what we read in those prayers is remembering and thanking the God, thanking God. You see Muslims fasting 30 days during the Ramadan. What is the purpose? Same thing. You first remember that everything given to you, the food, the health to eat, stomach, and the digestion system, and everything, was essentially God's mercy. Once you stop doing that, you feel the pain, and then you understand the basically what a mercy it is. And at the end, while being thankful to him, he tells you to go and help the others that who need food and help. Yeah? So we do charity is strongly encouraged, especially in that month. It's purpose, basically serving the same purpose. And then another pillars of Islam is charity, just like we have in Christianity. There is a minimum put in 2.5%, which is called zakat in Islam. You're supposed to give, but on the other hand, that's the minimum bar. So so there's no maximum bar. So it is also to serve the same purpose. I mean, you are thankful that God has given you wealth, so you give back to others in an appreciation. So this is how I would really summarize what in general religions are, as well as Islam. Just a quick brief history of Islam that you can even find in Wikipedia is the Prophet Muhammad. Prophet Muhammad was born in 570 in Mecca. Most of the people in that time were idol worshippers where he lived, and some from Abrahamic religions, some descendants of Abrahamic religions. There were Jews and the Christians in the community, but mostly idol worshippers. And when he was 40 years old, is 610, he was mostly leaving the city and going to the mountains to remember God, actually, because his parents came from the Abrahamic thoughts. So he used to go to the mountains, go to the caves, and to remember and worship God, even before a religion was revealed to him. Of course, by the way, all of these, I don't expect any of you to agree with that. And when he was 640 years old, he said that, you know, God has revealed him his verses. He's basically commanded to be a messenger of God. And again, what is his duty? To remind people what I just said. You know, recognize God, be thankful to him, and help the needy and the poor and the weak. So 610, as soon as he claimed that he's the prophet chosen to convey the message, there were 23 years that piece by piece verses were revealed to Prophet Muhammad. You know, at least that's what the Muslims believe. And the 600 pages of Quran that you see, which is about 6,000 verses, came in 23 years, 23 times, you know, 365 days, piece by piece, based on different events. So that's why when you look at Quran, it's good to know, because sometimes the verse is not clear. Where did it come from? What's the context? You need to know the context, because it came through that 23 years times 365 days, piece by piece. Sometimes two sentences, sometimes one, sometimes five every day. So it's how it's accumulated. So they were just like Jesus has been, just like Moses has been, just like any prophet has been. Prophet Muhammad and his followers were also persecuted by believing in this new religion. They were basically killed, harassed, and there were 3 years of what is called boycotting years, where in 3 years between, I believe, if I'm not wrong, 617 and 620, nobody was allowed to sell anything to Muslims, buy anything from Muslims, marry Muslims, and you name it. So they had to sometimes eat the grasses and everything for that 3 years. 620, that ban was lifted with some miraculous events. 622, when he was 52 years old with his couple of hundred followers, he had to leave Mecca to another city because they couldn't live in Mecca anymore. They would be killed anytime. So there was a few days of traveling by foot city, Medina. They, on foot, had to travel to Medina. People in Medina welcomed them. And they had a pact there. Actually, this was part of the discussion we had 1 year ago here. I consider that a very important, actually, contract between different religions that I know, to put down the standards to live together. There is a contract called Medina Contract. Basically, in that, the Jews and the Christians and the Muslims and non-believers in Medina put together a contract saying that, okay, so nobody is going to expose their religion on others, number one. Number two, if any of us is attacked, we will defend each other. Number three, number four, they put down the rules. And they lived together in Medina. Medina was, there were many Christian and Jewish communities and non-believers as well, and of any religion. So 632, when he was 633, so he lived in Medina about 11 years, 11 to 12 years. During that time, Meccan people, to destroy them, gathered armies three times and attacked the Muslims in Medina as well. After three battles and there were some peace agreement in 632, without having any battle and war, Muslims returned back to Mecca after 12 years, 632. And we talked about forgiving people, which is, to me, very impressive. I wouldn't do that. I mean, to be honest, if somebody... So 632, when Muslims returned back to Mecca, they were, of course, much more powerful than they were 20 years ago. And not a single person was punished when they went back to Mecca. It was forgiven. I consider myself, you know, if somebody kicks me out of my home, tries to kill me just because of what I believe, and you know, if I lost all my houses and everything, belongings, and I won't come back 20 years ago, would I forgive people? I don't know. I'm not sure. So 633, when he was 63 years old, he died, and Muslims live in the rest of the world. I already mentioned the basics of it. Basically, believing in God, one God, believing in his messengers. There were 27 prophets stated in Quran. But in one of the verses, it says that maybe God has sent messengers every century to every tribe. But it's not stated. We don't know their names. There might be other messengers over the thousands of years. 27 messengers, very common with Christianity, right? Jesus, Moses, Jacob, Joseph, Abraham, and you name it. So Aaron, 27 messengers were declared. And the most significant ones, of course, is Jesus and Moses. Actually, the most name stated in Quran is Moses. The number of times it's stated is Moses. And there is a verse in Quran about Mary, big chapter about the Mary herself, how Jesus was born and how she had to leave the where she lived to give birth to Jesus, etc. And Muslims are supposed to, they have to, believe in all the prophets. So if a Muslim says, hey, you know, I believe in Prophet Muhammad, but I don't believe in Prophet Jesus, he's not a Muslim. He has to believe in every prophet. And that they all had the scripture. So that's the second, and believing that there will be a life after death, hereafter, is another one that you have to believe in. Because anything that is stated in the Quran, you have to believe it. And these are stated in the Quran. And charity, giving charity, you have to. And going to Mecca, Kaaba, only once in your lifetime, if you are healthy and if you are wealthy. Otherwise, you're not. You don't have to. That's, I guess, in summary, that's it.
Thank you. Fatih, yeah, I just learned a lot right there. But I appreciate the way that you were able to crystallize that overview of Islam. Josh.
So let's go ahead and open. Thank you, Fatih. Thank you for that nice retrospective and overview. Appreciate it greatly. And let's open with some questions that hopefully are geared for both of you engaging around similarities and connections. So the first question is, what are the barriers that you have seen in our respective religious cultures that have made Christian and Muslim dialogue difficult? What have we seen in each of our different things that have made it difficult to engage in this topic?
I can start. Okay. Well, there have been a lot of barriers that I've seen, but probably perhaps at the core of them all, or feeding into some of the other ones, is a bit of what I talked about in the sermon this morning, is looking at appearances and making assumptions without personal engagement, personal interaction. Certain things happen in the world, certain things happen in our country. I was just with my sons at the 9/11 memorial on Friday, and I had never gone to the museum. I don't know how many of you have. I'd been to the memorial, but not the museum. And it tells in quite a lot of vivid detail the different aspects of the story and of how things came to be and how people responded and whatnot. It's beautifully done and very gripping and powerful. And I was struck by that, how much of what was prepared and took place and how people responded to what took place was so much based upon an appearance of something and immediately jumping to a conclusion instead of people being able to recognize the humanity in the other, the value in the other. And that's just one example. You see it throughout human history in a lot of different settings. And you see people from our country on various sides of those kinds of conflicts too. We've been the one inflicting that kind of harm, and that was an example of a time where a part of our country was inflicted upon and had to had to live our way through that. But that would be, to me, at the core, beyond the fact that there are some differences of the way we see things or believe things, that often it's very daunting for us to move beyond the surfaces and to even run the risk of reaching out a hand or opening our ears and being able to get to know someone who's from a different religion or a different culture, different tradition, and to see where that goes from there.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think the first obstacle is each side not knowing the other side. If you don't know someone, if you never seen him, you would believe in anything that is told about that person because you don't know the person. But if you just even shook hands or just drank coffee 5 minutes, at that moment you'll say, no, you know, I have seen that person. That person cannot be like that, right? So I think the first obstacle is not knowing. Everybody, all of us are living in our own boxes, and we think that the rest of the world is like us only. So that is and what is the reason for that is, one of them is this fear factor that we have to go over. Second part of it is that I'm guessing that you will say that it's similar in Christianity, is that I will talk for Islam, is that many Muslims don't know what Islam is. They don't know the Islam. So I have seen a survey that was done in Turkey. 92% of the Muslims in Turkey haven't read the Quran once in their life, in the language that they understand. It's just 600 pages, 90-something percent. And it was probably 5-6 years ago in my hometown. We were sitting with my relatives and we were discussing something, arguing something, and there were about 10 people. And I said, who read the Quran from end to end in Turkish, right, in the language that you can understand? There was not a single person in that room. And they were, if you asked them, they would consider themselves as conservative Muslims. People don't know what, and then when you don't know the religion itself, you just go with the hypes and the theories and, you know, all these things. And when you don't know the religion, you mix up the priorities. What is the most, you know, there are this and that, but what is the most important thing if you read the scripture? You mix up priorities. Details in a given religion becomes as if it's the most important thing. You know, populism gets into picture. I would say that's another thing. Not knowing the religion itself. If you know the religion, I just read the verses, right, from Quran, what's telling about how to engage with the non-Muslims. Are you going to reject the verses in Quran if you are a Muslim? That is the verse. Tell me, you know, what it says. And as Brian said, at the end of the day, you have to accept that, you know, we have differences. We have differences, but nothing prevents us to go with our differences but cooperate on our common goals. And we just read the common goals, the violence and the wars and poverty, opium crisis, you know, domestic violence, you name it. Those are all common issues that we all have to get together and solve.
So a follow-up question to that is, what have you learned about your own faith by engaging with people and connecting with people outside your own faith? So what have you learned about your own personal experience of Christianity or Islam by engaging with those who are not Christian or Muslim?
So I think the one thing you learn is your commonalities, right? So we just talked about, you know, we were reading Exodus and Matthew, and, you know, I just read the verses in Quran. So many overlaps, right? So commonalities on the being justice, helping the poor and the needy, and relationship with your friends and your parents. Messages are the same. I guess another thing is that you learn is, if you are afraid of your beliefs to be discussed or learning about other beliefs, you have a much bigger problem. You are not sure about your belief. You should go back and check your beliefs. Do you really believe in them, or is just that it's just culture for you? You know, if you are, that means you're not feeling secure. So I think that tells you also that it's not the problem. You have a bigger problem that you have to go check.
And I think I'll tag off of that a little bit in that sense of what do we gain? What have I gained personally from interacting with friends from other traditions? It's been a good opportunity for me to look a bit more inside myself and to ask that question, well, what do these beliefs mean to me, my own beliefs? And why do I live in the ways that I choose to live? And why do I understand my faith in the way that I understand it? At times, just listening to Fatih or being in dialogue with him has been an amazing gift, not only because I'm learning about Fatih and I'm getting to know him and I'm learning more about his tradition, but it's almost kind of like you get another focal on the lenses of your glasses. You know, these are technically bifocals, but I still look under them to read because the bifocals don't really work. My dad has trifocals. But it's like that. It's almost like you don't get a whole other lens, but you get another nuance and shading to the lens you have, which helps you understand your own faith with more nuance and more depth, partly through seeing it through someone else's eyes, I think, is how I've really benefited from it. And that takes it back to then, who am I as a person of faith, and what does this mean to me, and why do I live it out the ways I do? Which goes back to what Fatih was saying, can be one of the barriers to conversation and to connection, is if we aren't grounded and secure in who we are, and what our faith is, and how we understand it, and how we seek to live it out, then we're always looking externally for some sort of validation, instead of knowing that validation's within. It's something God's planted in each of us. So I've appreciated the interactions with Fatih, partly just on that level.
I'll add just a few things on that topic as well. So just the concrete examples that we learn when we engage and we live in non-Muslim majority countries, right? My father-in-law was here. We had a new baby 2 months ago, so they were here. He is a very conservative Muslim, he never left my hometown in his life, right? So he's 6 years old. So he came to U.S. So there are two Eids in Islam, the after Ramadan, and there is one more 2 months later. So there is an Eid prayer that morning that people come together, Muslim pray together. And we are blessed to rent either convention center or Hillsborough Stadium, other places, for hundreds of, sometimes close to 1,000 Muslims to come together and pray that morning, right? So I wanted to take him to the prayer. I had a different purpose, not praying. Praying is one thing, but... So he saw the prayer, thousands of people, Hillsborough Stadium, with the freely coming, praying, and freely without any security risk, even the police are basically patrolling the area, leaving, right? So I told my father-in-law, you know, you have seen this. What do you think of, what if there were thousands of Muslims in Istanbul, thousands of Christians in Istanbul in Christmas Day, gathered in one of the biggest stadiums of the Istanbul, freely with their own dresses, traditional dresses, came, prayed, and left in security. Can that happen in Istanbul? Can you say it can happen in Istanbul securely? So he paused. Because I wanted him to see, you know, that... we cannot always expect the freedom for our religion only one directional. We also need to provide the freedom of religion for others. And we were having another discussion within the community, actually, with some others, in maybe outside the community, inside community. It's a controversial topic, but I just learned that inside the whole Saudi Arabia, it is not allowed to build a church. I didn't know that until some time ago. And many Muslims here freely enjoy building mosques in the United States. So if you can build mosques in the United States, you should be able to build churches in Saudi Arabia. And then I went to the website and searched. Actually, there were about 2 million Christians in Saudi Arabia, mostly as a workers coming from Philippines and other countries, and it is not allowed to openly practice your religion in Saudi Arabia. You can do it in your house, but not outside. Well, you come to U.S. and you build mosques and you can freely enjoy, so you cannot do that other way around. I mean, there's only one place in Saudi Arabia, which is the Kaaba. You might have seen the people go for the pilgrimage. It's only 2 square miles. Okay, fine. Nobody wants to build church in that area anyway. So, but Saudi Arabia is bigger than Texas and everything, right? So what about the rest of it? So it's not fair. As a Muslim, you come here, you build mosques, and you freely enjoy the freedom of religion. And then when you go back to Muslim-majority country, you don't allow churches. So these are the things that you learn when you also come here.
So before I open it up to questions, I just want to remind everybody there are note cards back here. If you feel more comfortable writing one on a note card and handing it to me to read, you're welcome to do that. I'm going to give one more question, and then I'm going to open it up to the congregation, those who have gathered as a whole. So here's the final prompted question. What are the emerging issues in our society and the world that each of our faiths can uniquely address, maybe together or individually?
Would you repeat the question again?
What are some of the emerging issues, so things that you see right now that are things that are weighing on our society and maybe the world, that our faiths, or as people of faith, we can uniquely address, or that we can address? Maybe not uniquely, but we can address as people of faith.
Just so you know, we didn't get these questions ahead of time. That's why I'm partly hemming and hawing. Yeah, well, the first thing that popped into my head and my heart is immigration. We've seen that. I mean, obviously, it's how this country came to be in its current shape and form is largely through immigration, and the issues that have arisen in recent years have just been a seedbed for conflict, it seems, and there are people all over the map and at loggerheads with each other, including people of faith, who just cannot, if one seeing through pink lenses, the other one seeing through orange lenses, and the other one seeing through blue lenses, and they just cannot convince the others that everything's blue and everything's pink and everything's orange. But it seems to me that crisis is the seedbed of opportunity, because of the commonalities in our traditions, that we can all agree on the rights of each human being as a unique child of God, and the rights for that person to live in freedom and to live in safety, and according to the founding of this version of this country, to freely express their religious faith, like Fatih was mentioning, whether that's in a mosque or sanctuary or a temple or in the mountains, wherever that happens, that's something that has been secured as a right. And we're recognizing increasingly threats to those rights, and threats to people who want to legally enter this country to seek asylum from places that are troubled with violence, and places that people need to escape from to a safe haven. And it seems to me that where I've been heartened is by seeing not only people of my own faith stepping up for those of other faiths, as Fatih mentioned earlier, that justice doesn't just go for the benefit of my people or myself or my family, but our call to justice is very similar in the Christian faith and in Islam. It is for the benefit of the other. It is for the sake of the other and the compassion and the flourishing of the other. And so the ways that I've seen not only people from my own tradition, but people of other traditions stepping up and standing up and advocating, however vocally or quietly that's done, seeing people come together for the sake and for the respect and the flourishing and the benefit of all, I think is a very, very real challenge and will continue to be, but is also a pretty incredible opportunity.
I'll just cut it short. Brian explained it very well. It's not one topic. It's, religions, both Christianity and Judaism and Islam and others, are commanding us to get together and solve these problems. I mean, these problems are common problems. Poverty and oppression of the others. And I have seen a good glimpse of it that, after the Pittsburgh shooting, synagogue shooting, I have seen the Muslim community raised a couple of $100,000 for the families of these Jewish community. That's the right thing to do. Stand up when the other was attacked, not when you are attacked. So then you can expect help when you are attacked.
Their original goal was 25,000, I heard, and then they've raised over 200,000. So amazing, beautiful.
So I'll now open up questions from the audience. So if you have a question that you'd like to give, please raise your hand and I'll bring the microphone to you.
So I think you do a great, I imagine it can actually be quite exhausting for people to always say, so can you summarize, Islam in like one sentence? And I feel like there are many people, whether they're of a different race or different religion or whatever, they're constantly having to do that for people who are not the majority. I don't think I, as a lay person, if someone came to me and said, so can you summarize Christianity in one sentence? I don't think I could do it nearly as eloquently as you have. And I think that might be part of the challenge, that in terms of how can I even have a conversation with people who are different from me I don't know if it's necessarily a lack of security in my faith. There might be an aspect to that, but it's also I just don't think I have the tools to be able to talk about that. And I'm kind of curious, this is more for Brian, if you have any thoughts on that and how, could you try and do what he just did to summarize Christianity?
Give me 5 minutes and I'll... No, thank you for that, Foy. I think that's a very remarkable and helpful insight. Because that is something, again, as I'm learning more about Islam, that is remarkable about the tradition, is how much part of the calling of the tradition is to internalize it. And even just the daily practices, some of which Fatih mentioned, and the annual ones as well, there's such a rhythm. Again, here's the drummer speaking. There's such a rhythm to that way of not just expressing and practicing your faith, but it internalizes it in a way that when someone does ask you a question, there's maybe a bit more instant recall that you can draw upon and say, oh yes, here's what it is. Now, I will say that each of us ordained clergy in the Presbyterian Church have to write a statement of faith, personal faith. My statement of faith is 72 words. And it's couplets. And so what I would probably try and do is recite that, if I can remember it. But that took me over 40 years to come to and to be able to distill. But it was actually someone who asked me the question. And I thought maybe we could be asking our congregations and asking each other more readily that question. What is your faith to you? Could you fit it on a business card? Or could you fit it in a tweet? Although tweets aren't 40 characters anymore. Unfortunately, they go much longer. But I mean, I think that's a great question, so I'm answering your question with a question, I guess, but are there ways that we can be putting that question more regularly in front of ourselves and to each other to help us really think about what does that mean, not just the folks who are paid to do it, but for all of us, our own personal faith? Okay, it was for me. I just want to make sure I'm not bogarting the mic here.
So my question is for Fatir. Thank you for being here today. And the question goes to the perception of Islam in the Western world, because what you have described for us today is a religion very similar to ours in many of the ways it functions in the world. But then when you speak about the experience with your father-in-law, where he acknowledged that it's impossible in Turkey for Christians to come together and practice their faith openly, as it is here for Muslims to practice their faith openly, how do you... I think this is where we run into trouble with the perception of Islam in the Western world, that what you're describing is not what is actually happening over there. So you're describing a religion which is tolerant and encourages other religions to flourish within the same physical space. But that's not what's happening over there. And I think that's where we run into trouble. So if you could just address that, like, why is that so? Why is there no religious tolerance there, even though the religion says there should be?
Yeah. Thank you for asking this question. So not... I was expecting that, and I was looking forward to that. You know, so you're talking about all these nice things in Islam and everything. What the heck is going on, right? So, another part of it. So, as I said at the very beginning, I will try to put down a few sub bullets. You know, I would summarize why those are happening. I guess, by the way, it's not an issue in Islam only. You look at when the Bosnians, tens of thousands of them were slaughtered in Bosnia, it was done in the name of Jesus for some of them. You can go through other religions. Unfortunately, ignorance is in any of it. And then, as I said, the main number one bullet is that we do not know the religion. We go with the populism, not the religion itself. Examples, right? So closing churches and everything. So there is not a single incident of it in Prophet Muhammad's time. Not a single incident. Where did this come from? And there is after Prophet Muhammad, his followers, the leaders of them, became the leader of the community. And the one of the most famous one in his being just, his second one is called Omar, second one after Prophet Muhammad. One time he was in Jerusalem. So he needed to pray. You know, Muslims pray five times a day. There's a window you have to pray, otherwise you miss it. So he wanted to pray, and then the priest or pastors of the church said, "You can pray in the church." They said, "You can pray inside the church." And he said, "I won't pray inside the church, because if I pray inside the church, I'm afraid that people following me one day will consider this a holy place, and they will close the church and make it a mosque." So because of that, he said, "I will not pray in church." He prayed outside of the church because he was afraid that his followers will consider it as a holy place and will turn into a mosque, right? So where is this coming from? It's because people don't know. I mean, many Muslims don't know about these details. As I said, 93% haven't read the Quran once, and the survey I have seen. This is first sub-bullet. When I look at, for example, these... this ISIS, right? What they call themselves Muslims had nothing to do. So I see couple of commonalities between them. So first, some of them, significant portion of them, are converts to Islam in Europe. And they are converted maybe by some of the radical thought people. And then they don't know what is, they just get, it's like pushing someone in the pool and trying to basically see what he needs to do. And he thinks he's going to accomplish something by doing that. And the second group of people I have seen is that uneducated people and had a bad background. I have seen a sentence. I was listening to NPR on my way to home. A lady made a nice comment, actually. I liked it a lot. She said, "Is the problem really radicalization of Islam, or Islamization of the radicals?" So basically you see quite a bit of people. I was looking at there was a guy who drove his truck to crowd in Spain and, you know, in Nice and others. When I look at all of them, they have a very criminal background. Quite a few of them have criminal backgrounds. So they are abused with those. It's essentially the Islamization of the radicals. So somebody go and reaches those guys who are lost, trying to accomplish some things. I can go on this list, but there's only one more thing that also I want to address. If you read Quran, if you don't know the context, that's why I started with this 23 years of revelation with the context. Because Quran is only 600 pages, it doesn't give you background. There are verses that you will find. You know, it will says then, you know, if you just take one sentence, it says kill the infidels, right? But actually, if you look at the context, when that verse was revealed, you read the before and after. After it says, but whenever there is a peace possible, make peace. The sentence after that. And if you read the context, when did it come? Remember I told you three wars that the Meccans get together an army to destroy the Muslims, and they basically came all the way to Medina with 2 years apart after the Muslims left Mecca. So one of them was Muslims were only 200 people, 200 to 300, the first one better. Meccan, rich, wealthy, well-equipped, 2,000 people, if I'm not wrong the number, army, came to destroy Muslims in Medina. And all Muslims, of course, naturally afraid. You have an army there which is much well more equipped than you and is 10 times bigger and came to destroy you. So the verses came during that moment to encourage the Muslims against that group. It was against a specific group. But for one way or other reason, I don't know, the verse doesn't say explicitly, oh, by the way, this is because of this incident, because of these people. So, and people who abuse religion, their goal is not religion. They are behind power. I mean, they are corrupt people behind power. They use religion. I mean, you know it in right now very well in the United States that certain people have nothing to do with the moral values of Jesus. Unfortunately, uses Christianity. And you know it in other places, people abuse Judaism to basically sustain their power. Same thing in Islam. Many people use Islam. It's all they care is their power. They take this verse out, and then they say, and those guys, as I said, haven't even read in detail where this verse came. There is another one I can quote against the Jewish people, right? So Israelites. But very verse, that verse came because it was talking about certain Israelites, I think if I'm pronouncing it right, that butchered their prophet. Basically, there were messengers sent to them, and they killed their messengers. It is only talking about those group of people, Israelites. And later you read the whole Quran. I mean, come on, Moses is prophet's messenger. How can it be against Judaism? Right? So there are those verses that are taken out of context and also nicely used, I would say, efficiently used to radicalize people, and they put all the other bad things happening, the killings happening in the world, and then they use religion. It's really, in most cases, Islamization of radical. I like that word.
And of course, we know nothing about that in Christianity, of specific verses cherry-picked out of context and used for very different ends. Unfortunately, it's one of the similarities I think we have with our faiths too, unfortunately.
So I'm going to read a card here, and then I'll get to the people that are holding their hands up. Also, too, for the people that just came in, there are cards and pencils here. If you're more comfortable writing on a card and writing your question, you can do that. What do you wish people knew about the role of women in both Christianity and Islam? Question is, I want to encourage everybody to keep the microphones as close to their mouths as they can. Yes, I know it's flu season, sorry. All right. What do you wish people knew about the role of women in both Christianity and Islam?
That we are created equal as God's children. that as human culture has evolved, so our understanding of ourselves and each other has evolved. And the most helpful way to approach relations between genders and other expressions of human life is perhaps not to use the bylaws of centuries old, millennia old, constructs that were helpful and useful and needed at that time. We really should have one of the women from the congregation sharing this. I feel inadequate as a man because I'm part of a gender that has largely misused. We've misused aspects, like we were just talking about, of our tradition to somehow put women in a role that they were not created to be subjected to. I get the sense that the beginning of our story shows men and women together, creating life together, living life together. And then one piece of fruit was eaten, and all of a sudden, sorry, mini sermon. We read Genesis 3, that very famous story. We then, it seems for centuries and millennia from there, have said, well, the Bible says that this is how it's going to be, and so that's the way it's going to be. Those are curses. The man shall lord it over the woman. The woman's desire will be, you know, to serve the man. And all of that, we forget those are curses. Those are not blessings. And yet somehow we sort of read over that. Just said, well, it says it in the Bible. I guess that's how it's supposed to be. And we seem to do that time and time again in our history. And for all the ways we have evolved, there's still a lot more evolution and conversion that I sense needs to happen in our own faith culture. Just even from the faith culture I grew up in, there's still a long way to go for us to see ourselves truly as equals and as equally beloved and equally valuable and equally gifted and equally empowered to be God's children together.
I think also agree, you know, the equality is the most important thing. And unfortunately, as I said, most of the what is known as religion is not really religion, it's the culture. People take culture as the religion. It's mixed up, unfortunately. So we don't know what part of it is the culture, what part of it is really religion. Many of the things that you see in the Muslim community, nothing to do with religion, it's just culture over the centuries, unfortunately. Prophet Muhammad's wife was a community leader, and it's always amazing to me because after Muhammad died, about 20, 25 years ago, I believe, there was an internal conflict about an argument, and Muslims were divided into two, and actually they even had a battle. They fought between them. And Safin battle. Safin. Is it Safin, Fatih? Is it Safin? Or, you know, and one of them, actually one of the sides, was led by the Prophet Muhammad's wife. And I was thinking, you know, this is 650, a woman can gather 10,000 people behind her and go to a battle to the other side, other believers. So it's not a good thing that they go to battle, I'm not saying, but I'm saying that the fact that she could gather 10,000 men behind her and go to battle about a conflict. And there's another verse, Prophet Muhammad saying, we call it hadith, saying that the heaven is under the mother's feet. So if you can't pass that, you can't go to heaven. The heaven is under the mother's feet. And one time somebody asked her, who should we love most? She repeated, your mother. And then he asked, who is next? Muhammad said, mother. One more time, he said, mother. And the fourth time, he said, father. Sorry, guys, but that's how it is.
Can I just add one other quick thing on that too? Thank you, Fatih, for that. You reminded me when Jesus was about to enter our society, who was the first one who got the news? Mary. When Jesus went through all of his suffering and oppression and eventually execution, who were the ones who stayed closest beside him? Women. Who were the first ones Jesus appeared to when he was resurrected? Women. To me, those are beautiful, powerful images that I hope will increasingly feed our understanding of our own tradition and expression of it too. If anything, we're later to the game. And I'm thankful for that. John, do you have a question?
So, one of the problems I have with both the Christian religion and the Islamic religion is the presentation of God as a male or father figure. It just permeates both religions and the particular book of each religion. So, how is this being addressed, if at all?
I'm thinking in Islam, God is not portrayed as man or male or female is God. But I think there's one thing that can lead to that is I was told by someone who has Arabic linguistic culture. If you look at the translations of Quran, you will see he when they talk about God. And it's because in Arabic, I was told that he, because it's culture of the Arabic, not because of Islam, and Quran happens to be in Arabic, coming in Arabic. In the Arabic linguistic, he represents the big power. So it is just the virtue of Arabic. And that's all I can say, I think. It's not that God wanted him to be known as he, but the Quran came in Arabic because Muhammad was Arab from Arabic world, and of course naturally it will be in Arabic. It's just the linguistics that he represented the highness, your highness, in that language. That's why the translation is as he in the English.
And that is another similarity between our traditions. Because the Hebrew, the Greek, although it's interesting, at least in the Greek, and in the newer translations of the Greek scriptures, there's been greater emphasis, especially about speaking of humanity as a whole, humanity, instead of saying the brotherhood of man or mankind, or just saying that this was, you know, the brothers gathered. Almost all of those words that appear in that text are from the basic word anthropos, which means humanity, human being. Kind of like in Hebrew, it's Adam. It's not just a nice name to name the first human that appeared in the story, but kind of like Simba means lion in Swahili. But yeah, so there's some built-in limitations in the traditions. What I'm encouraged to see in my own tradition is that there's been a greater interest in looking deeper into the spirit of those texts and the heart of the languages to get at what Fatih was talking about, that God is beyond gender. But that because of the limitations of human language, you have to be able to communicate God in such a way that humans can talk about God. And I think Christianity has, in some ways, a double challenge with that because of the belief in the divinity of Jesus. And that, so then when God comes in human forms as a man, and then some people will argue, well, that was the culture. Again, if a woman came, who would listen to her? But here comes a man, a rabbi. Well, maybe someone will listen to them. I don't know. I mean, a lot of that is speculation, historical speculation. But what I am encouraged by seeing is an increasing amount of effort being put into understanding those texts and understanding tradition in a more open-minded and egalitarian sense and less tied to a specific gender for describing divinity. And whether that's in the newer songs or newer translations or just in the ways that we're trying to have conversation with each other and the artistic renderings that are coming from the faith communities, I think, are showing that more egalitarian side. I'm also fascinated by the ways my tradition is depicted in other cultures. And that opens up a whole other vista of ways that a faith tradition and an image of the divinity can be expressed that I think can really build bridges.
I see the similarness of our religion being, and agree with that. But I think, and it's being mentioned now, that it's the culture that comes out of the religious practice. I think that is the most difficult part. I see it as acculturation and bringing it into politics a little bit. We in the United States don't agree on our own religion. How we interpret it. And so then when someone comes in from a different culture and looks different, then it's, I think, magnifies that. And I'm from Europe, and I heard you mention Europe and the acculturation there of your people and the problems there. And I was wondering, with your practice of your religion, do you have problems here in the United States? To fully practice, yes, your daily life?
Actually, I have to say no. I'm thinking, is there anything that my religion requires me fundamentally that I cannot do in the United States? No. I mean, praying, I can pray. Actually, I can give you examples. That's why I also try to, whenever I talk to people from Muslim-majority countries that they have never came outside, I want them to know this so they go back and tell others there. Hopefully it doesn't change in the future, in here as well. We all need to work that it doesn't change. For example, in Intel, I work in Intel, I'm an engineer. I have been there for 16 years. In every building that I was working, there is a small room dedicated for Muslims to pray. In for example, today's building, we have a big room, actually, maybe half the size of this whole room, for people to come go and pray. So I can go to the restroom, get my we call fudu, wash your hands and everything, so and then go and pray there. Of course, I always knew that there is this 10% of the United States that has the anger when they see, you know, my wife also wears headscarf, and they have been quiet because they didn't have the courage. Now, unfortunately, in the last few years, they have the courage to speak up. They had the hatred of Islam, but that is in every country, so I have to be fair. My wife came here 10 years ago. She wears headscarf, which is more open to, you know, discrimination, let's say. We, in general, maybe we are living in a different part of the United States. You know, Portland area is different. It doesn't represent the whole Oregon or whole United States. 95% of the time, we never had any issues. You know, there are a few cases here and there, but that happens everywhere. So in any country, I have to say that I can whatever is necessary, dictated by my religion, I can do it here. Few other representatives from Islamic community, so maybe I don't know if they want to add to it.
So we have about 5 more minutes of our discussion, so I'm going to read one question from a card, and then I'll come up to the front there. This is kind of piggybacks off that a little bit. Where and when could Christians attend a local mosque or Islamic center for prayers and worship? And what should Christians be aware of to be gracious guests?
There are multiple mosques, but the one that which is closer to our house, that's why we also go, and we have relationship with the presidents and others. Actually, the president of the mosque is also my colleague at Intel. He's 50 feet to me. So there's a Bilal Mosque. And Bilal Mosque, few times a year, they do open house for all people of all religions to come and, you know, learn and visit. You can go anytime. But they have specific also open houses a couple of times a year. It's on TV, close to TV highway. It's called Bilal Mosque, and it's bilalmasjid.com or .org. It's on the website. And then there are more. There's, I think, Masjid Sabr, which is close to I-5. That is one way of meeting the Muslim community. But during the year, you can go anytime. But if you really, another time to go, if you want to go anytime, is there's a Friday prayers. Friday prayers are at, I believe it's at, you can go to the website and you can see it's 12:30, and in the summertime it becomes 1:30, the noon prayer. There is a, 20 minutes preaching during the Friday prayer. That is when the most crowded people you will see during the week, because Bilal Mosque, I think there are about 200-300 people come there during the noontime. They have separate places for women and men. Yes, it is one difference. Now we are talking about differences. In Prophet's time there was no. It's divided by a few doors and they have a separate place, but it is next to each other. So one thing that you want to pay attention is, if you are a lady, go to the ladies' place, and if you are a man, go to men's place. You can go anytime.
And Fatih, I'll get that info via email, and we can pass that around. Yeah. Okay, so final question.
This is the lighter side of culture. So in the Christian church, we tend to see a greater attention to our kind of festival times, like Christmas and Easter. We get a huge influx of people and participation in what's going on in the church and around the church and around the church life. And then sometimes it sort of falls off a little bit, and then people come back again. Do you have that sort of cycle in the Islam as well?
Yes, I think the two main ones are the two holidays that I mentioned. It's called Eid in Arabic. One is after the Ramadan fasting 30 days. After that, there are 3 days of festival. It starts with a morning prayer, and the whole community come together in the open field, and then, there are gatherings in the houses and things like that. And the second one is 70 days after that, two months and 10 days after that. That is where there is you will see Muslims sacrificing animals or sheep or goats and whatnot. And there's a history of it in the Quran, and in Muslim beliefs it was sent by an angel to Abraham, etc. So that's the second Eid. Beyond that, other than these two, I don't know if I can get help back there. So there is the birth of Prophet Muhammad. But it's not mostly as a festival. It's mostly in seminars and things like that. But these two Eids are like the Christmas in Christianity, and I guess Good Friday or Easter. Yeah.
Q again for coming. Fatih, are you willing to stay around, or gentlemen, are you willing to stay for a few more minutes if people have questions they want to ask? I think, honestly, I could say I could keep talking and engaging for at least like 2 more hours around all of this. But I want to respect that it is lunchtime and allow people to head on to the next parts of their lives. But if you have questions that you'd like to ask, feel free to come up and talk to these wonderful gentlemen that are here with us. So thank you again, Fatih. Thank you, Brian, for being part of this conversation. So appreciative. So thank you.
Thank you.